Welcome to the Property Couch, where each week you get to listen to two of Australia's leading property experts as they share with you the insider's guide to property investing.
All right, folks, you're on the Property Couch, your insider's guide to property investing. I'm Bryce Holdaway, co-host of Location, Location, Location Australia on Foxtel's Lifestyle Channel. And he's Ben Kingsley, the chair of the Property Investment Professionals of Australia and also the current Property Investment Advisor of the Year. Now, listeners, we just had a little bit of fun then.
We did.
We actually asked Ben to open the podcast, and what we're going to do is we're going to cut it and leave it to the end of this podcast.
Oh, beautiful.
So you can see that this bloke is very good at many things, but let's just say opening the podcast is probably not his strength. But luckily for you listeners, he's got lots of really good stuff to share when it comes to property investing. Now, Ben, we're going to do some Q&A today. We've received a question from Chris.
Great.
Hi guys, I'm finding your resources very useful and insightful. Can you address investing in trusts? In particular, purchasing property through trusts and transferring currently owned investment properties into a family trust. Lots to go through there.
There is, and again, another tax question. So we've got to be careful in regards to any tax advice. We're not licensed tax agents, so we're not going to be giving direct tax advice. So we'll be sticking to the facts. And the facts are these. Again, it's another structure. It's another vehicle in which you can invest through. If you do talk to tax accountants, they'll tell you that a trust is not a legal entity. So effectively, the main reason why you would look to set up a trust is for asset protection means. And that is to be able to control the asset whilst not actually potentially owning it. So a trustee is put in place, whether that be an individual or a company trustee, and then from that information, you can then determine whether it's the right vehicle for you. So I'll just cover off quickly on the four. Individual name, partnership, company or trust, or the other one which we talked about recently was the SMURF, buying property in a self-managed super fund. So they are your options when you're thinking about going on this journey of property investing. And I think it's important to understand why you would do it and, again, go and see some professional advisors. But, Bryce, have you got any further away?
Yeah, I've been involved in the professional side of property investing as well as investing now for 16 years, and I've seen a lot. And I've seen a lot of people going and getting excited by the idea of trust. But for me, it's often sold on the premise of fear. Mm. And to give you an example, it's usually, you know, what if you were driving down a country road and you happened to crash into the farmer's prize bull and he sued you, or you crashed into a Mercedes and someone wanted to attack you and get everything you've got. Now, they are legitimate things that people need to be concerned about. But we've got to, in my view, you've got to have a realistic view about whether some of these things are actually going to happen to you or not. Because for me, I used to always say to people that talk to your mortgage broker first, because you've got this many options, like heaps of options in your own name. Mm. As soon as you add a trust into the mix, the financing options are limited. So the point here for me is very, very simple. There is legitimate cases when a trust makes sense. But if you are doing it based on a premise of someone selling it to you on fear, I would actually encourage you, invite you to unpack those fears a little bit more and just see, are you likely to be sued? Are you likely to run into that farmer's prize cow? These are events that may happen to you, but they also add such huge complexity to the picture if you don't necessarily need it. Because if you're a pay-as-you-go income earner, it's very difficult to use trust as a vehicle because the losses get trapped in there.
Yeah, they do. So the losses are getting trapped inside the trust until such time as the trust is generating a positive return. Now, when you have a trust structure and you can have a unit trust, you can have a discretionary trust, often referred to as a family trust. You can have blood trusts. There's quite a few different types of trust structures which you can do. So blood trusts are about trying to focus on keeping the asset in the family lineage as opposed to the next generations, when maybe you partner up and have a new wife or a new husband, that they will get access to that estate. So it's about controlling the assets from the grave effectively. So some of the big things people often ask me, you know, when they're coming in to do a property plan, you know, do I do this through that vehicle? And I always say to people, they're expensive to set up. They're expensive to keep going from an ongoing basis. So you need to work out how risky it is, as you said before, Bryce, in terms of being able to mitigate any potential risk. If you are getting promoted to set up a trust for avoiding tax, well, that's illegal. ladies and gentlemen. So from that point of view, tax avoidance is illegal in this country. Tax minimisation is not illegal, but if your primary purpose is to pay less tax, and that's the reason why you're setting up a trust structure, then effectively you're in breach of the law. So it's important to understand that. And the other little surprise is land tax is also higher. It's higher in regards to the cost that you pay, because effectively trusts were for rich, old, historical families. And with the advent of technology and solutions and product departmentalizing, you can now, you know, set up a company with a click of a button on the internet. You can set up these complex structures. So it's becoming a little bit more mainstream. So again, I would be focusing in on understanding all of the pros and cons. And if you're sitting down talking to an accountant for a good period of time, you should spend an hour or so in fleshing out the pros and cons of this. The other one is around capital gains. You don't get the exemption. So if you're a forced seller or you decide you want to sell, you don't get that 50% concession if it's inside a trust. And finally, they've been tightening up the distributions in family trusts and discretionary trusts where you're able to distribute around $3,000 to dependents or beneficiaries. Now that's being tightened right up. So the reality is that these types of structures, when most people pick them up and the tax office don't get the revenue that they're looking for, they'll make changes to them. So I've learned that over the 20 years I've been doing this.
Yeah, I find investors often look for a little bit of adrenaline when it comes to property investing because they get excited by the idea of building their wealth and building their financial future, which is great, but they want to renovate, they want to subdivide, they want to get a trust structure in place. Adding complexity is kind of, in my view, sometimes confuses activity with accomplishment.
Yep.
Because ultimately, if you can keep it simple, build a couple of properties into your portfolio, have the end goal in mind in terms of our passive income, and then get the debt structure right.
That was gold. Activity.
Don't confuse activity with accomplishment.
That's a really good point. Just, you know, if you hear someone at a barbecue saying, I've got these trust structures and I've got all these complex structures, you know, do you think, well, wow, they must be well off? When in reality, it just could be, again, a bit of crap that they've set up and they really don't understand and it may not be appropriate for their needs. So that's a bit of gold.
Well, the analogy is if you're standing on stage in front of let's just say you're at the barbecue with your mates and you've got a rocking chair and you sit in the rocking chair and for the entire length of the barbecue, you sit there and rock. Now, you're doing something for a couple of hours, so there's the activity, but you're going nowhere, so there's no accomplishment. And that's ultimately what I suggest, that sometimes this happens. Now, I want to make it really clear that I'm not antitrust.
No,
because I think it's appropriate at certain times, particularly if you're in a highly litigious environment where you are likely to be sued and you've got an above average likelihood of that happening to you. It's no problem. If you earn a business income and you earn your income through a trust like I do and you can distribute to a trust so that those losses aren't trapped, again, it's got some merit. But all I'm saying is, again, to labour the point, don't confuse activity with accomplishment when it comes to trusts.
And the second part of Chris's question here refers about transferring current owned investment properties into a family trust. Well, that would trigger, in most cases, and I've only just I'm dealing with a client at the moment, and they are trying to move a property from a trust structure into a personal name. And what's happening there, and vice versa, is my understanding in the majority of cases is that would trigger a stamp duty event. So it's very expensive to move that property now. He is getting some pretty complex advice, and the circumstances may be that it should never have been done in the first place. So if they can show evidence of that and get a private ruling from the ATO or from the Land Tax Office in this case, because that's where stamp duty is collected, then they may be successful. But as a rule of thumb, any transfer of assets from one entity into another will trigger a capital gains event or will trigger a stamp duty event. So it's important to understand that. Once you pick your vehicle, it's got to be your vehicle for the long term.
Very, very good advice as per usual. Christian Capito, one of the topics that got me interested was tax depreciation when you had Bradley Beer, who's a very good friend of ours.
He is a good man.
Come in as a special guest. I already have a depreciation schedule with Brad's company. The one thing that plays on my mind is whether it is worth renovating an established property. Oh, can of worms there. Is there a rule of thumb that I should use to... Well, actually, let's do this in part. So should you renovate an established property? Can I answer that quickly by saying I'm a degree qualified accountant, so I love depreciation as much as the next guy, particularly when it comes to property investment. But I don't think you should buy depreciation at the expense of growth. I would actually prefer to get the growth and then create my own depreciation, whether I do that down the track, but through a very well-managed renovation project. So my answer to that is very clear. Quite often, yes.
Yeah, so my addition or adding to that, Bryce, what I'd be talking about there is if you're talking about adding a $100,000 or a $200,000 renovation to a property that would see it exceed the established benchmark or over-capitalising in an area, then it's not smart. You know, you should never invest for a tax deduction. It's just plain dumb. I mean, why would you try and make a dollar to save 30 cents or 40 cents? It just does not make sense to me. So the reality is that if you're going to do a renovation, it must be appropriate to the return on investment you're looking for. And we have a very simple rule of thumb that if you're going to add value, that every dollar you spend, you want to try and get $2 back in terms of that value add exercise. And when you do spend that dollar, yes, there will be depreciation attached to that investment. If you're putting a second story on, if you're extending out the back, then no doubt the full depreciation schedule would be wise, but don't spend $200,000 to make a $700,000 property worth $900,000 when the market has $900,000 properties in them. Mm. It doesn't quite make sense to me that you would be doing that. You'd be leveraging off the coattails of the area, getting the drag up value, and you're having a property that in reality will have more renters that will give you a better yield. If you take the value to a higher point, you may sacrifice yield in doing so.
Mate, you've got plenty of good points to share. Now, I guess that all comes down to asset selection, as Ben said, and whether or not you would renovate an established property. But the point here is if you talk to the guys at BMT or someone like BMT, if you buy an investment property, for example, and in a year's time you plan to renovate it, they can actually get a couple of depreciation schedules done so that you can use the tax laws that are in place. Again, no tax advice here. Talk to your tax accountant. Talk to the guys at BMT. But there's an opportunity there for you to, let's just say, maximise the current rules that exist for you to get as much depreciation back as you can. And that's if you're planning to renovate down the track.
And Brad, this will probably put a smile on his face if he's listening. Don't forget your scrapping. Mm. So if you are going
to... that's my point.
Yeah, if you're going to scrap those assets, then make sure you get that secondary one, which is what you're talking about. So it's referred to as the scrapping depreciation.
Ben, here's one for you. Is there a rule of thumb that I should use to determine whether my investment property needs to undergo a renovation?
Rule of thumb. I would like to keep my assets in a reliable and good order. So the minimum level of condition I want in a property is that reliable and durable. So if my asset is reliable and durable and it's hard wearing, then I would usually hesitate in doing a renovation on that asset until I've milked out the longevity of that. And then at that point where I felt that the asset wasn't reflective of the current rent that I could achieve in the demographic profile of the area, then I would consider kitchens, bathrooms and the basics to get that right. Not necessarily radical structural stuff, but it's really about accommodating for the market. So if I feel as if there's more uplift in yield that I can get, I would consider it.
Yeah, I've got a rough sort of framework around whether you'd renovate, because I think renovation can do one or more of the following. It can increase the rent, increase the value, increase the amount of depreciation you get, and then help the tax cash flow. So if the cost benefit gives you positive in one or more of those categories, then it's a pretty good...
it's a good rule of thumb.
Rule of
thumb. It's a ripper.
My house in Minto, New South Wales, is a detached house. It's around 20 plus years old, and I know they will be able to get tax benefits for renovations. But is there a golden rule to this on when is the best time? Maybe this can be the Q&A segments you have.
Yeah, I think if you've already got the depreciation schedule on it, you'll know what's left on that. I know he mentioned I've already got a depreciation schedule on it. So if we assume he's got a depreciation schedule on it, then his tax accountant can quickly work out what's left over. Mm-hmm. And then when he's going to work out what type of renovation he might do, and if there's some structural stuff in there, you can quickly get quotes from builders and carpenters, and you can work that out, and then you can work out what appropriate depreciation is attached to that. Because some assets, fixtures and fittings, can be written off fairly quickly, but some of the more structural stuff has a longer depreciation, diminishing value type model. Mm-hmm. So it is going to come down to doing the numbers, unfortunately, on this one for you, Christian. But the good news is that if the house is well positioned, it's not that old at 20 years, it's probably still got another 10 years of you know, reliable and durable wear and tear. But if it's not attracting a tenant because it's tired and washed out, first thing you always do is look for a paint job. Paint changes everything. That's the number one rule of renovating. But ultimately, it's going to come down to crunching the numbers.
These guys do it all day, every day, Ben. They're writing hundreds and hundreds of reports. Have a chat to them in terms of
the guys at BMT.
Best time. So thanks, Christian, for that question. The next one is the signs of gentrification is our topic. Andy here. And Andy looks like they're from Eastern Europe because I can't pronounce that. So maybe the sign off today is from, is that maybe Czech Republic?
Yeah, I reckon.
Sorry, Andy, I can't. Kajowski, perhaps. Who knows?
Yeah. Kajowski?
Yeah. Let us know if we've got that right, Andy.
It's Kowski at the end. We know that much. It's the first four letters that are stumping us.
It is. Which part's silent? What is gentrification and what are the signs? Does this take a long time to happen? What are the positives and negatives of buying in a suburb that hasn't had it or is in the process of having a facelift demographic change? I'm assuming that is what gentrification is. Thanks, guys. The podcasts are gold. Thanks, Andy.
This one's a cracker, and I've only got a few minutes to talk about it, but I really want to start to get people to understand the importance of what gentrification is. In great areas, so we're getting into some technical analysis now, in great areas, blue chip locations, the gentrification's already happening, the status is already there, the human interest and the human behaviour, the lifestyle drivers are there, bulletproof locations traditionally. The only time you expose yourself in those locations that we talked about before is high-rise, medium-density rubbish that's in those locations. The other thing that probably gives you a bit of risk is if you're buying the absolute premium value in that location where, you know, when the marketplace, the share market corrects itself, you're going to have some challenges where we see volatility in that top 25% quartile. But if you buy the median price in those blue chip locations, happy days, usually for the long term. You can still time the market and there'll still be some flat periods. But what is gentrification? Gentrification is usually in areas that are closest to the CBD, so closest to employment centres, closest to public transport, closest to the public amenity that we're looking for. And what takes shape is affordability drives people into these areas. And the trick here is to focus in on the arts community. So the arts and some architects who are trying to buy a blank canvas and make it groovy. Because when the arts community, which are leaders in trend and commentary and are usually, you know, artists, journalists, those types of things, when they're going into these locations, they are getting spruced a little bit more, which is quite good. And so, I mean, one of the greatest stories of gentrification is Soho, which is in sort of a downtown part of New York. It was all factories. It was close down to the Brooklyn Bridge area. And it was basically where, you know, all the homeless used to reside. Now, because it was run down and dirty, obviously people saw potential in it. And so they went in there and they made it groovy. And it's now one of the most groovy parts with unbelievable restaurants and bars. And it just has that lifestyle driver and it's close to the proximity of the employment center. That's what you're looking for in cities. So you can see usually workers' cottages or areas where the lower socio-demographic was in. And unfortunately, they do get pushed out as the new upwardly mobile professionals start to come into that market. That's what gentrification is. And it doesn't happen in small cities. When I say small towns, I should say cities, it does happen. But in small towns of 20,000 or less, hard to do that. You're better off focusing in on the blue chip areas of those smaller regional towns where you've got consistency and low volatility. But when you're coming into the city locations, you are absolutely, you know, primed for potential uplift as an area moves from what we would call a green chip to a blue chip over the course of 10, 15, 20 years.
It's a derivative of location because what happens absolutely is people go, well, I want to live in the leafy east, and so I keep getting further and further out, and all of a sudden they go, well, I don't want to sign up to this anymore because I have to commute for an hour and 20. I've got this mortgage that's a noose around my neck. Whereas if I go to the other side of the city, which has still got some period homes, it's probably wasn't...
You're talking Melbourne here, aren't you?
Melbourne or Sydney or, you know, even Adelaide, for example. But ultimately, they go, well, I didn't sign up to this lifestyle. So I might go to the other side and may have had a bit of a stink on it in the past, but I can get myself a period home for half the price. Mm. I'm only 6 train stops into the city to get to my work instead of 13 or 15. And ultimately what happens is, you know, like you said, with the bohemian lifestyle, people are just starting to say, well, I've had enough and I want to go into another area where I can create a bit of a lifestyle for myself. So again, it comes down to location. And I guess a telescope view of that right now is, people are kind of thinking, well, Sydney and Melbourne are getting outpriced, so I might even make the move to Brisbane for the lifestyle and the sun. But even when that starts to move, they're going to make the decision on whether or not they're going to, you know, we had this chat last week about if I'm in the western suburbs of Sydney paying $1 million for an average home, not a great one, an average home, and I'm commuting in 1 hour and 20 each day to get in, this isn't really what I call a life. So they might take a backward step in terms of income. They might go to another city that's got a slower pace of life, and then they might look to get close to the CBD, which they couldn't do in Sydney, for example, and start to gentrify an area and bring new money, bring more incomes into the area, and ultimately that's going to continue to drive the price.
Yeah, it does, and I think that's the message here. It's subtle. You don't see it happening overnight, but sometimes it's also the pink dollar that goes in there, so the gay and lesbian money, which is double household income, no kids usually. Mm-hmm. So that also, you know, and they're very proud of the image that they portray around their houses and their area, and they spend, they love to spend. So that obviously creates the little coffee shops and the restaurants and the pet chains to sort of come into those locations. All of those are good indicators of an area that's gentrifying over time. So not only are also the people who are sort of saying, I've got this eastern suburbs or this high blue chip country and I'm forced out of it and I don't want to go wider. But what also happens is there are some people from the middle class and the lower middle class who are breaking through that ceiling, becoming doctors, you know, they're getting a great education for the very first time. And that's all putting pressure also. So those eastern suburbs still have those great incomes, although those rich suburbs still get the great incomes and that they continue to thrive. But those gentrified areas get these new people coming in as business grows, are getting six-figure salaries. And when that happens, it allows for that pressure on that inner city because they want convenience, they want lifestyle.
There you go, Andy. That's our views on gentrification. I think Footscray's a classic example here in Melbourne. I mean, when you Google it, it's, you know, in the past, you didn't accidentally put Footscary for a reason, you know, but it's changed. It's totally changed. People, young professionals are happy to move into Footscray, which has changed that demographic. It's definitely gentrified, and it's consistent with what we've talked about. Close to the CBD, it's got some period homes in place, public transport's very good, and the bohemian lifestyle is starting to gentrify the where I go and get a cup of coffee, where I get my bacon and eggs on a Saturday, and that just continues to bring more people to an area.
Great job. I mean, it can be a little bit grungy, can be a little bit sort of scary. So you're sort of taking that next step on it in terms of you're making a decision around that'll change. And so the very early adopters of areas, I mean, Alexandra is a great one. In 2001, I was in there and, you know, McDonaldtown and all that area, it was grungy. Mm. And now grunge is cool and the pink dollar's in there and it's just a thriving area. And that $395,000 property in 2001 is worth over $1 million now. And that's an example of, you know, how you get those types of results.
Imagine that, location doing 80% of the heavy lifting.
Amazing, isn't it? maybe our listeners will get onto that.
Lewis McKee sent us one. Love the podcast, guys. A great resource for anyone in the property industry. Thanks for saying that. However, I find the majority of the discussion revolves around Sydney, Melbourne, and sometimes Brisbane markets. Well, that might have been a segue from the previous one. Can you offer any advice regarding property investment in a regional centre? Often there are a lot of stones unturned in these markets. I am based 30 kilometres from the coast in central Queensland, and medium high density development is a relatively new concept to most buyers in this area. That's what we might labour on. However, recently completed projects have shown a real interest in this type of offering versus detached dwellings, and I'm wondering how to interpret this.
Are investors coming in thinking they're doing good with their money? So it's not an accepted living standard for the majority of people. People don't want to move from freestanding houses and detached housing into units just yet. So if you're looking to sort of see other people move into those and have low maintenance and you're seeing it in a major number, then I'd revisit that idea. But right now, it's basically a developer stock coming in and people thinking they're making good money, and it's usually going to be interstate investors. And unfortunately, most of those developments fail. I'll give you some great examples. Harvey Bay in Queensland there. There's been a lot of development around certain areas of Harvey Bay, and they've been very slow. So it had a little bit of a boom, and that creates the excitement and, you know, the sort of speculation. And then all of a sudden it stumbles, and then it stagnates. And then the investors work out, well, hang about. Redcliffe, another great example of what happened on the Redcliffe Peninsula there. So there's people who originally bought in there who still haven't returned their original value of what they paid for off the plan some 6 or 7 years ago. So there's some that it remember, we've always talked about how great it is for lifestyle. If people are actually living in them, and it does good for the restaurants, the bars, and gives a bit of livability score. And in some cases, great pubs open, and you've got that sort of dining experience. But in reality, they're not the assets we buy. We'll cherry pick around those, won't we?
Yeah, Lewis, you want to make sure, you want to find out how many local buyers are buying them versus, as Ben said, interstate, international buyers, because I think that's going to be a real key KPI for you to understand that. But your first point about discussion
towns, yeah,
revolving around Sydney and Melbourne and sometimes Brisbane, that's because most, as I said in previous podcasts, most people buy real estate to live in. 70% of the market is owner-occupiers, 30% to invest. So ultimately, we've got to find out what people want in certain areas as to what they want to buy for an investment property. So we think that income drives largely the location, and therefore location does 80% of the heavy lifting. So the reason being, if we want to be statistically safe when we're buying an investment property on behalf of ourselves and on behalf of our clients. So you only have to think about the mining story to see that the incomes on offer there were enormous. I remember doing an episode of the very first series of Relocation Australia when I was up in Newman in the far north of Western Australia, where I had to pay $40 for a T-bone steak at a roadhouse that was surrounded by red dust. I remember going into the client's house who I was helping buy a property in Queensland at the time, and they lived in a standard three-bedroom steel-constructed home that was over $1 million. And I just was, my mind was
blown. With the corrugated iron walls. That's the best part. You walk in, it's like, wait a minute, the walls are corrugated iron.
But before I understood the income story, I could not get my head around why would someone pay $1 million? Now I understand the income story very well. But the point is, now there's blood on the streets in these mining towns, which is because they don't have the security of a capital city job market. So one product, one customer, meaning the iron ore into China, when that price is now dropping down to $30 a tonne, up from its highs of 100, that makes a huge difference on that particular market. So it's about being statistically safe when you're investing. So can you make money in some of these regional towns and some of these regional locations? Of course you can. But as an investment and as a risk profile, if your risk profile is low, that's why often the narrative is around the bigger cities.
So, Lewis, if we're going into a regional town, we're usually looking for yield with the prospects of growth, as opposed to the other way around. You know, in a major city, we're looking for growth, and then income will follow in terms of rental yield. So, and so what's our number one driver for regional towns? It must pass the lifestyle test. Okay, so the only reason why I go out to a mining town is because they're paying me $120,000 to drive a Tonka truck around. Now, that's an amazing amount of money for basically low-risk, low-skilled work. So the question there is, once those jobs dry up, I'm out of there because I want my money to go back into that lifestyle centre. So when we do look at regional towns, the number one gateway for us to say, would we invest here, is lifestyle. Does it pass the lifestyle test? Is there great livability? Is there good schools? Is it a good community? Am I close to water? Am I close to, you know, do I have great golf course, whatever, great weather? All of those things combine to make the livability score of an area really important. So there are definitely regional towns that your number one thing you look for is that, and they will have growth, but they also have great yield. And what's the yield story telling us? Well, If it's got great yield, sometimes it's like, well, I'm only going to be here for a short period of time. So it's a transient sort of decision to make. So it's important to understand that, as my co-host has a little cough in the corner, to get to that sort of position. So we'll do more of unpacking regional story around economy and so forth in future podcasts. But just think, if you are going to buy into these centres, you want to go into cities or towns, I should say, that have a minimum population of around 20,000 people or more. diversified economy, an economy that's on the move, and a centre that's attracting people to live.
Because as an investor, you want to be a price taker, not a price maker. And Ben always talks about the three pillars of economic activity, human interest, and human behaviour, and he's talking about some of those now. So again, very, very good insights. And thanks for your question, Lewis, and hopefully that's helped you out. Send us a little note just to let us know if there's any sort of subsections to your question. But there we have it. We've cut through a bunch of Q&A, which we appreciate that people have sent through to us. We're just going to quickly cut now to Ben's intro.
Rightio, in a changing of the guards for this week, I'm going to do the intro, Bryce. So welcome to the Property Couch, your insider's guide to property investment. You're here with Bryce Holdaway, the co-host of Location, Location, Location Australia and Relocation, Relocation, which this was another great show that you also did. And I'm some bloke who has all to do with property investing. I'm the chair of the Property Investment Professionals of Australia and the current Property Investment Advisor of the Year. So let's get into a Q&A session, Bryce. Over to you in terms of our first question. It's...
That was good.
What stage was that?
There you go, folks. I think it's fair to say that I should open all of the podcasts going forward.
Yeah, but, don't give up my day job, mate.
Mate, stick to your knitting, but you're good at your knitting, so that's a good thing. But, mate, I think we need to do a sign-off around the world today. Where are we going?
We're going Italian, mate.
Are we?
Yes, although, you know, I'm sort of... I think it's ciao.
Ciao. I'd say it is ciao.
Ciao. No, it's nothing. Anything different than that?
No, I think...
Okay, we're over and out.
There we go, folks. Ciao. We'll see you next week. Thanks for listening. See ya.